Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop. The Legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris connects people like you with podcasts, videos, and live experiences about artists and topics you love. Check out OsirisPod.com and sign up for the newsletter to stay in the loop about new podcasts and events. And don't forget to check out the new Leftover Salmon record, Something Higher.
Hello, Road to Now listener. Seems that by being here means that you like to get information by listening to it. You might be listening right now in your car, while you're driving, maybe you're mowing your grass, maybe you're just sitting in a room by yourself staring at a wall. In any case, you're learning by listening. I like to do the same thing, which is why a couple weeks ago, I went looking for a new audiobook company and I came across Libro.fm. Libro.fm is an audiobook company which allows you to purchase your audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for bookstores around the country, and also a playlist curated by The Road to Now featuring our past guests. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobook at the same price as the other audiobook companies, whatever they are, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to, check out recommendations from our podcast featuring guests including Jefferson Cowie, Douglas Brinkley. There's so many of them. You can go check it out. I made the playlist myself, and I'm really proud to do this. The best part about Libro .fm is that you literally are sponsoring your local bookstore. And if you're anything like me, you really like your local bookstore, but sometimes you want audiobooks. Well, here is the solution to the problem. Road to Now listeners can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month. That means for just $15, you can sign up and you'll get 3 months with one free book. And if you're anything like me, you're going to download a giant biography of like Grant or something and listen to it over the course of a month. It's all the same price, $15 a month. How do you get that? All you have to do is go to Libro.fm. That's Libro. Letter F, letter M, and enter the promo code RTN at the top of the page. And they also have gifts. You can buy a gift for somebody if you're looking for that special holiday gift. Give them the gift of knowledge. Just go to Libro.fm, enter the promo code RTN, and we thank you for listening.
I'm Bob Crawford.
And Ben Sawyer. And we are the future of influenza.
We are, this is the Road to Now, and we're dealing with nagging colds, as you may be as well.
Yeah, we hope you're not. We both have young children that we sent off to whatever petri dish they live in, and they bring us home all types of presents, sometimes hand-drawn, sometimes biological. Yeah, so here we are, and you know what the best place to go is? Speaking of the cold?
Oh, it's Antarctica.
No, just the opposite, Bob. Quite the opposite. The Arctic.
Oh, yeah. So we're doing this show about the Arctic, and all week I thought we were doing a show about Antarctica.
I remember, like, I was in my 31 when it occurred to me, like, Antarctica and the Arctic, like, actually the ant actually means something different. Maybe everyone out there is listening, like, we thought these guys were smart, but they're not. Or maybe everybody's listening going, we understand. But Antarctica is the south. The Arctic is the north. Ant versus, you know, the opposite side. And this is about the Arctic. And I was so excited. And the way this worked out was I was at the Slavic conference, the AC's conference that I go to. And someone mentioned to me that Allison Smith, who I've known for a long time, she does Imperial Russia at the University of Toronto, said that they had worked with her on a course on the history of the Arctic. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Because we always look at maps and we think about things from the side, right? The Atlantic, the Pacific. But there is a whole Arctic world up there that binds together in weird ways, like these countries, Norway, Russia, Canada, the United States, you know, even Sweden and Denmark are in there with it.
And now China.
Well, China's trying to get in there, but they can't get a border up there unless they take well, let's not get there. They may have territorial ambitions in the far east of Russia. But for now, everyone's kind of interested in this area because not just from a environmental point, which is very important because we're seeing the Arctic recede, but as the Arctic melts, it is opening up new potential shipping routes that a lot of players are interested in.
and we're seeing this play out. We're seeing the changing of the map and the changing of trade, and this is the world changing. We look to the past and we're like, oh, the map used to look like that, and these were the trade routes that were preferable, and these were the trade routes that caused the war. But now we're seeing it play out again because of climate change and because of the ambitions of Russia and China, and Canada has a great stake there. So that's a very important region. And people want to know, is there oil there? You know, what is up there?
Yeah. And have you ever wondered why countries like Russia, Canada, the United States wanted to take over those areas? Because the people that live there, they're native peoples in the same way we have out west. But they've been very much a part of the story of colonization from the beginning of colonization. Some of the first attempts of the English to colonize the New World came, brought with them interactions with native peoples there. And so these are all the questions, and we were lucky enough to, I would say, maybe corner at the conference, but for properness, I'll say, ask politely Allison Smith to join us. And she brought on her colleague, who she co-teaches the class with, Heidi Boecker, and they were amazing.
Yeah, it was a really great interview. And you know, when I finally realized what we were actually talking about, I feel like I've learned a lot. And it taught me also that, you know, I don't look at the world geographically. And it's important for us to be able to point to a place on the map or on the globe and be situated and know where we are. So
that's right. And speaking of where we are, we assure you listeners that we were not as sick as we are now when we recorded this episode a couple of days ago. So
I was a little sicker. I'm getting better.
Really?
So, yes.
Well, we assure you that Bob pulls it off better than I do. So we hope you enjoy our interview on the history of the Arctic with Heidi Boecker and Allison Smith. Stay well. Heidi Boecker and Allison Smith, welcome to The Road to Now.
Hi, thanks for having us. Thank you.
I'm really excited to have you guys, because just a backstory real quick on how this happened. I was at the Slavic conference, the ASCES conference, this last year. I had a bad idea, which was like, I'll find people who just want to talk to me about history at this conference. As it turns out, they do that all day and they want to drink beer after they're done. That's reasonable. But I started talking to a grad student of yours, I think it was, and said, oh yeah, I took this great class on the history of the Arctic with Allison Smith. And I was like, whoa, wait a second, really? And I found you, Allison, and I cornered you. And I was like, hey, if I email you in a month, will you be on the road to now to talk about this? And now you're here and you've brought Heidi with you. So I'm excited. And, you know, I want to start off with this question. You know, some people might be like, well, you know, why has Ben so excited about the Arctic? But there are a lot of reasons for it. One has to do with like the way we see the world. So the way we understand the world is so shaped by the maps we grew up with. We grew up with these maps in our schoolrooms. And, you know, Bob and I were just talking, you know, some maps have the United States in the middle of the world. That's a value judgment because it splits a continent in half. Some have, but most of the ones you see in the United States, if they either have the United States or they have the Americas on the left and everything else, Europe and Asia on the right, that privileges the Atlantic world. When we think about the world, we think about the Atlantic as the center, the US as the center. Sometimes we talk about the Pacific world, but we never think about the Arctic as being a center. But in reality, there's a Pacific world, there's an Atlantic world. We can probably talk about an Arctic world as well, if we think about it this way. So to start off, could the two of you start by explaining what defines the Arctic and how thinking in terms of an Arctic world can help us understand the world today?
Well, I just wanted to start by saying neither Allison nor I are historians of the Arctic. In fact, I have most of my research, my principal research and teaching area is actually in the Great Lakes of North America. And Allison's a Russianist. And so we came to this with the same kind of sets of questions, I think, that, you know, you just came to right now, but we did not come to it, and we still don't come to it from a position of it being our primary area of research.
You know, I'm really glad that you specified that, because I'm also not a professor or an expert in the Arctic. In fact, I thought our topic today was going to be Antarctica. And in fact, I don't know what grade, I mean, probably first grade, my son learned his continents. And that's where, you know, I'm not a geography person. So, I mean, there, I think I know more than the average person as far as geography goes, but this is something that I'm really excited for our listeners to learn about, because I think as North Americans, as American citizens, we neglect this part of the world that you're going to tell us has a great impact on our life and our future.
Yeah. Well, and I think this sort of came about through a random conversation that the two of us had years ago now.
After a film.
Heidi, was that... Sorry, this is not exactly an answer to your question. It's a slightly more rambly thing. But that is what we do. So Heidi was asked to comment on a film that looked at... it's a sort of odd... I shouldn't call it an odd documentary, but it is an odd documentary, called Passage.
Yeah.
Which is a bit about, it's about the Arctic. And we started talking, and she was telling me about this film, and I started saying, well, you know, there's sort of interesting different things that are going on in Russia at the time of this film that you're looking at. And we said, oh, we should teach a course on that. And I mean, really, we had not that much more thought going into it than, hey, we both look at countries that are heavily Arctic, and yet we haven't really ever sort of put that at the center of what we think. And it's such an interesting thing because, you know, when we think about Russia, the first thing that people think about, oh, it's cold in northern and cold in northern, and not necessarily all that much more than that. And also, you
with
know,
Canada, despite the fact that, you know, 90% of Canadians live within 150 kilometers of the Canada-U.S. border, it's the true north, strong and free. And that's how Canadians define themselves.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a big presence in both countries.
Mm-hmm.
And as we also started to grow the course, we looked as well, obviously, at the Scandinavian Arctic mm-hmm. and other ideas of Arctic. And as to your point about geography, the Arctic doesn't have a continent, right? So but there's definitely a circumpolar community. There's been a strong circumpolar history, lots of connections and trade routes and strong desire from the 16th century forward to have sailing routes mm-hmm. through either the Northeast or the Northwest Passages.
One of the things we really had to grapple with very quickly was how strictly we were going to interpret, like, what is the Arctic?
Mm-hmm.
Because you could do, like, is that just, are we only looking within the Arctic Circle, or are we looking at the zone of permafrost, or are we looking at all of these different sort of ways of thinking about the Arctic? And we ended up being a bit generous, I would say, in our definition of that. So we could say include most of Siberia in the Arctic, even if that is not necessarily entirely accurate. But what we tried to do was sort of be conscious of exactly looking at a map from a different direction mm-hmm. and looking at the map. Like, so when you look down from the North Pole, like, what does that look like? We first taught a version of this class as a small seminar, and this was like eight years, it was a while ago. Mm-hmm. And on the very first day, we brought big sheets of paper, drew big circles on them, and had the students get together in pairs or small groups and say, like, just draw a map with the North Pole at the center, just to see, like, how they would actually, could they do that? And then compared it to an actual map that shows that. And it was really fascinating mm-hmm. to see, like, certain places were forgotten. Alaska was always there. That was the one thing that everybody got, was Alaska, and then a bunch of sort of, like, islands. And then maybe Greenland, maybe, you know, something like that. But it was a great way of trying to sort of say, like, this is just a point of view that we're not really used to thinking about. And yet when you do this, it does bring up these sort of fast, like, sometimes it's individuals who cross from one side to the other. Sometimes it's just sort of interesting parallel developments on the two, on the, like, the two sides. It's not two sides on this entire circumpolar region. And so that ended up being... a lot of work to teach this class because it's neither of our specialties, but a really fascinating one that I think was incredibly rewarding, certainly for us as teachers and hopefully for a fair number of our students too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also the Arctic is a peopled place, really, again, not something that's in our consciousness. And when we talk about climate change and the impact today on the Arctic region, again, we forget the people who live there now and the people who lived there historically and for millennia. The focus of my own research is broadly on Indigenous history, but to really delve into the Indigenous histories of the Arctic region and to look at the tremendous technologies people developed for living well in a region that, you know, is quite lethal if you're not careful, spectacularly lethal potentially, and with very limited resources. The stone homes that the Thule Inuit built, or just with a whalebone and hide covers, quite comfortable dwellings over this incredible landscape.
So why don't we start there? Let's talk about the people of the Arctic. And what do we know about them? How long have they been there?
Gosh, a long time. That is a little bit of a debated point. Yeah. And I have to admit, I would need to go back to my notes to answer that incredibly accurately. What I will say is one of the things that I think was really sort of enlightening for me as a historian of Russia, not that I had ever thought of Siberia or the far north as an unpeopled place, but being conscious of thinking about this as a peopled place was has actually altered a couple of things about the ways that I actually teach just my regular Russian history class. Mm-hmm. And I'll give one example of that. You know, one of the stories of the rise of Moscow to prominence is that the Principality of Muscovy is that it's the gathering of the Russian lands, or you know, that's how it's the sort of like Russian nationalist version. It's like these were all Russian lands that were there. But it includes like lands that are actually populated by Sami and Komi and Udmur. And like, so there's this idea, like when you actually look at these northern regions, you realize the ways that sort of Russia's imperial story actually begins sort of much earlier than we often think of it, which I wouldn't say it was quite mind-blowing for me, but was a really helpful corrective, I think, in a lot of ways of thinking about how I actually want to talk about some stories that I, not that I haven't thought about them, but that I have been telling in, you know, a fairly static way kind of up until quite recently because of this.
Right. And the, you know, going back to that, it's the Cossacks go across the Urals in the 1580s, right? The Yermak goes across, and then a couple of decades, they've gone all the way to the ocean, and they're so proud of themselves for that. And my favorite story is, speaking of maps, you know, this article by Mark Basson, that during Peter the Great's time, they overemphasized the size of the Ural Mountains to make a geographic boundary that proves they've conquered.
Make a bigger feat to cross them.
Yeah, and this is amazing, right? So spatialization, right? They changed maps under Peter the Great to make it appear, okay, we're European. We're European. Now, all you other European countries, you've crossed oceans to conquer your people. But aren't mountains a giant geographic barrier that only a superior people could cross as well? And they go into these areas and we forget that, you know, so many of the peoples living there lived independent lives. You know, the Chukchi, there's some great articles by Willard Sunderland on this. And they go there. But the question becomes, why? What is it that drives Russia? What is it that drives Canada? What is it that drives the United States to take, particularly at a time where you're not talking about, you know, having the resources to drill for oil or even understanding it's up there or necessarily minerals. Yet these countries care about taking this space, conquering this space and holding it down and making it part of their modern project. Why is it that they care?
Excellent question. And they care very early. They care before there's a Canada. They care before there's even colonial settlement, the first colonial settlement in the United States. So like when you think about the English who had founded the Muscovy Company at the same time as they were searching for the Northwest Passage, and you think of Martin Frobisher and his expeditions in the 1570s, three expeditions in the 1570s. That's before Roanoke, Virginia is established, right? Yeah. And they're the third fleet. I mean, they take over a huge fleet to mine. They're looking for minerals. Frobisher returns home with a cargo full of fool's gold, so that didn't work out so well. So Inuit in the Arctic are encountering these voyages of European colonization and exploration in the 16th century, right? And then there continues to be this strong interest in looking for that Northwest Passage. So that's a big driver, the search for a faster transportation route for European countries to get goods from the East, the Far East, is a huge driver of those missions. And of course, by the 17th century, especially for both the French and the English, but it ends up being the English because after the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, they get Hudson's Bay.
The battle for furs, and the
market, the demand in Europe for furs, they're pretty much depleted their own fur-bearing animal supply, and the incredibly thick and very valuable pelts of everything from Fisher and Martin and Mink and Beaver, of course, are what are driving those voyages. And then on the far coast, the Russians, it's also the otter, sea otter trade later.
Well, and I think I mean, one of the interesting questions there is, what does it actually mean that they care about incorporating these lands? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sort of, certainly one of the tropes that comes up all the time in Russian history is that it's not the land, it's the people who live on. Mm-hmm. Like, so you, if you're a serf owner, the amount of land you own doesn't matter, it's the number of serfs you own. And right. I do think there's actually a sort of interesting parallel to that in this colonial expansion, because it's not just like incorporating the land, it's that you want to be able to collect taxes from people in these places and, you know, collect taxes or collect, yes, you know, like collect furs, yeah, collect whatever tribute. It is you're going to get. You want produce from the people on these lands. And then that comes into, you know, so I think a lot of the initial movement isn't necessarily consciously about like expanding into all of these lands. It's sort of incorporating more people into your fiscal functions as a state. And then in the 17th century, when you start to get these maps drawn of, say, Siberia, that start incorporating the Arctic. And it's so interesting that Semyon Remezov's maps, which are sort of these early maps in the 17th century, they're fascinating because, among other things, like the north is in the bottom of the images. And so you end up with the known Muscovite world in the like bottom right hand corner. Mm-hmm. And the Great Wall of China is actually in the top left hand corner. So it's also like this fascinating alternate vision, I think, of these spaces. I don't think you could geo-match them very well without dramatically warping the originals, but they still give a sense of, now this is a space that we have incorporated. They feature all of the rivers that let people move back and forth. You know, so there's this sense of this place that is not simply ours, but also connected by these, you know, potentialities for transport, which at this point are rivers. And I do think one of the things that sort of you realize as you sort of look at this sort of northern region, as you realize also in the Eurasian Arctic, you know, that was connected in some ways to the larger, like the more southern Silk Roads, you know, these sort of overland trade routes to the south, you know, maybe not on an everyday basis, certainly, but like, there are these connections that sort of like, there are just distinct different sort of connections between Arctic and South. Not that there, I'm sure, weren't connections.
No, there are. I mean, if you look at the Eurasian continent, and Allison's exactly right. I mean, there were 9 major rivers, which is a fact I learned from teaching this course with Allison, but dumping into the Arctic Ocean and bringing with it, in fact, a lot of the driftwood that ends up on the Canadian Arctic side is actually from Siberia. And there's only one river that drains from the North American continent into the Arctic Ocean, a major river, and that's the Mackenzie. And it's on the far west side of the continent. And so there's a lot more Arctic tundra in North America than there is on the Eurasian continent. And that does have a huge impact on the human history. And it also, I mean, we thought there were so many similarities in this course as we were teaching and researching it. But you do see these major differences, too. Like, Europeans were using, once Hudson's Bay was discovered and mapped and known by, you know, by 1610, and then the Hudson's Bay Company is chartered in 1670. And from that point on, the Hudson's Bay and James Bay are a route into the interior. And they're a way for the English to compete against the French, but for the middle of the continent. They're not interested in the Arctic anymore. They're interested in using the Arctic to put their forts in James Bay and then to travel down those rivers into the interior to pull those furs out. You know, and by the 18th century, when the fur market in Europe starts to get into trouble, France is propping up its fur trade. It's not really profitable anymore, but they're keeping it there for the alliance relationships they're making with indigenous nations in order to secure their geopolitical ambitions. So that's one of them. And there isn't this tribute or economy in that context. It's about trade. But by the 18th century, part of that trade is about conflict between England and France over the North American continent.
Yeah, and Russia doesn't have that. It's not really competing with anybody. No. Apparently it is true that the sort of Muscovite expansion through Siberia might have been more northern, were they not a bit concerned about the British who kept looking for the Northeast Passage. It wasn't just because it was colder up there that they moved farther to the south. You know, so there are things like that. But it does, you know, there are these sort of startling similarities and also startling differences.
So is there any record of these early interactions between Europeans or Russians and the indigenous people of the Arctic? And did they run into the same situation as indigenous peoples in Africa or in Latin America or, you know, in the Southwest?
Yeah, I mean, there are records. The written records from the earliest days come from the Muscovites as they mm-hmm. move into Siberia and sort of record mm-hmm. various things. But then there are also, people have later collected, I guess, oral histories from the indigenous populations of Siberia to sort of talk about their memories of the coming mm-hmm. of the Russians. So there's sort of, they get these sort of different versions of the story that are similar. There are definitely things like, and I will say that Yuri Slozkin's book, Arctic Mirrors, has a lot of really beautiful, well, also terrible, sort of illustrations of these early years. And there are things that are really similar. So you get, you know, a case in which there's a lot of like, well, let's get the, let's get people to trade with us by giving them sugar cakes or things like this, or sweets or vodka or things. And then there's also cases in which, you know, there's violence used to compel people to give things. So there's absolutely sort of a combination of like the carrot of trade and the stick of violence that happens all the way through. And there's also, you know, there are spreads of diseases in slightly different ways than happen in North America, but it is a, you know, another part of the story. You also get, you know, like one of the stories is that like there's a lot of different indigenous groups in Siberia. I mean, with the, this is why the modern Russian Federation still has something like 200 languages spoken in it. A lot of those are from the different peoples of Siberia.
That's a foreboding place to live, right? I mean, at this point, the climate of the 17th century, 16th century, it's cold, right? It's not like it is today. It's probably still very cold. So what are the Russians or say the French or the British, what is their impression of people who can survive, I mean, who live there and have created their own technology? Is there a respect? Is there an astonishment? Like, what do Europeans and Russians think of these people other than trying to compel them, just as the Dutch did to the Indians in New York, and, you know, with violence and with bribery, if you will? You would think that these Westerners come across these people that live in the literally the last place on Earth that you would expect people to be.
I think in the Russian case, it's not that stark in some ways. And part of that is because of the really different geography of the Eurasian Arctic. Like, the tree line is actually really close to the Arctic. There are trees much further north in the Eurasian Arctic than there are in the North American Arctic. So this is the thing, that there's significantly more, like that image you have of like people living on a harsh white sheet of ice isn't as, you know, like there's just less of that land in the Eurasian Arctic. So I don't know that there's a lot of, like, at least among the Russians, of a lot of being truly impressed by people living in dramatically, like, well, we live in the cold too. So I don't know about this, but I think the situation's really different.
It is really different. And I mean, you can go back again to Frobisher's expedition. There were some wonderful paintings done. We'll send some along by John White, a British painter. There was a great deal of fascination with, for example, the kayak and the umiak technology. Inuit people had waterproof clothing that they made from seal skin and also from seal gut, and sewed in a particular way that the stitching never went through. It was a double stitching on both sides, so that you never penetrated the hide to produce this kind of really incredible waterproof and very warm and functional clothing. So they were impressed by the crafts, I mean the watercraft. They were impressed by the survival clothing. They adopted it. And Frobisher himself, they kidnapped people and took them back to England to, you know, a kayak on the Avon River and demonstrate their prowess. And they unfortunately all died from various diseases contracted while in the UK. And certainly you can see that initial respect, but you can also see in later voyages, like, for example, in the Franklin's expedition, which is, you know, one of the conversations that got us started on this research, that in the mid-19th century, you know, the British were really confident in their science and technology. And so they developed their own Arctic gear. And people in the field found that actually the Inuit gear was still better. But that didn't stop the British from insisting on using their own Arctic survival technology because of not wanting to, quote unquote, go native, right? That was by three centuries later.
Well, and then it's also, it's not something that just stops at the first moment of contact.
No.
Because I think one of the, and I'm just thinking of the early documentary film Nanook of the North, which is actually, I have to admit, like, it's one of those things I had known that it existed, but hadn't ever actually watched it until we took this class. It's totally available on YouTube, incidentally, if anybody wants to watch it. And it's a really fascinating thing, both for the ways that both as a relic of its time, but it is like a big part of it is like, look at these people and look at how they live in this unbelievably harsh environment. And yet they're happy. I mean, like that's one of the, like the happiest people on earth is one of the ideas behind this, which is a little bit disconcerting in various ways. Then I think that gets borrowed by, and there's this much more recent documentary that came out of Russia that the original Russian version was sort of like four separate hour and a bit parts. And then it got recut by Werner Herzog as this film, Happy People.
I love that documentary. Oh my God. It's so great.
And yeah. Which is also, but there is this like fascinating thing that comes with like the harshest place on earth, and yet people are happy there. So like it's an odd like there's something about like the freedom of the North to like live as a person. It's sort of like all of the imagined wonders of living a like life in the wild come to the forefront in these visions of how people come to live in the Arctic, I think.
But isn't this? I mean, is it fair to say that? I mean, one of the things that perhaps makes this. One version appealing to the Russians, but the other version appealing particular, I can only speak for myself as an American here. But like, isn't it that idea that like somehow the Arctic and the notion of the Arctic conquering that nature, like there's something about like it especially with the, you know, the fur trappers who go off by themselves. There's something about the individual, the guy and his dog, you know, going off for months by themselves. I mean, I think there's something that appeals in a very real way there to like modern notions of masculinity, modern notions of, you know, independence and self-sustainability. That stuff's all fascinating. In the 19th century, though, and I want to get back to this because, you know, the way that we relate to nature has a lot to do with, you know, political ideologies in ways we don't think about. So, you know, I, speaking of documentaries, when I was getting ready for this, it was a good excuse to like dig up some things. I watched a PBS documentary on the Greenlee expedition. It is fascinating how these spaces get caught up in like kind of the geopolitical mindset of the time. So if you look at like what happens in the United States, one of the reasons the U.S. government was willing to fund this expedition in the 1880s was to go further north than the English had been, to go further north, to make that claim for America. Later on, the Arctic and the Antarctic become places that in the Cold War, if you can go there, it's you know, as I teach my classes, one of the problems with the Cold War is, you know, before if you were an empire, it was easy. You just took over land from people, you killed them, you showed them you were stronger. Look at these new guns. It was a way you could show off that you had the best technology. The Cold War, you got to act like you care about people. So now, what's the best place to conquer? The places that takes the technology to conquer where there aren't people living. So you go to the deep Antarctic, you go to the moon, you go below the ocean, you do more exploration in, you know, distant regions of the Arctic where there is nobody, where nobody's ever really been before. You know, so when you look at this, is it the same, you know, with this, you know, I know the American side, but is it the same with Canada? Because Canada isn't often thought of like, you know, we're going to show you guys we're the best country in the world in like the U.S. Soviet sense. Is Canada up there going, hey guys, we're also going pretty far north too. We're going, and they put it in kilometers because they're from Canada, so nobody understands. Like,
no, we had miles before back in the day. it's really interesting because when you think about Canada and Canada thought of itself, you know, when Canada became Canada in 1867, when Canada achieved Confederation, as we drill into our students, Canada didn't become an independent nation state then. It didn't until 1931. So Canada couldn't make external policy. It didn't have control over its external affairs until 1931. So, and Canada's identity until the 30s, it starts to shift, but it was really caught up in the British Empire. Think about the Canadian flag. Canadian flag dates from 1965. I know, eyes are bugging out there, right? So like my parents grew up and under the red ensign, right? So when I went to elementary school, we sang God Save the Queen. I'm not kidding. So the people are looking and nodding. So the orientation was towards Britain, and our identity was caught up. I mean, that's not to say there wasn't an emerging sense of Canada and Canadians. There's certainly been lots of scholarship on that, but so that creates a different kind of national project, right? Because the Canadian project was more of an imperial project, and that's not to say Canada didn't try to colonize the North. In fact, when Canada was given the Arctic islands in 1880 through a secret order in council, because Britain didn't want the United States to find out about it. If it was an act of parliament, then it would get in the newspapers, and then the Americans would find out about it. You know, in 1880, when that order in council, Canada was granted all the Arctic islands that were known and might become known, because the Western Arctic hadn't been fully mapped. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, it was just a fact of the time. So there was interest in supporting expeditions, and certainly in the there was a great Canadian Arctic expedition that went on during the First World War, actually, to map the Arctic. And Canada did put money into, it was a big 4-year expedition. It reported back in 1918. Of course, the end of the World War, World War I kind of trumped the news of the Arctic expedition. But they did a lot of science, did a lot of mapping. There were big efforts to map the Barren Lands and expeditions sent out in that. And then some imaginative visionaries, like Stephenson's plan to set up muskoxen farms on Ellesmere Island and to colonize the Arctic as kind of Canada's polar Mediterranean. Which, Dee wrote books about this. It
didn't really make a lot of sense,
and the idea never really caught on. But, and in the Canadian popular imagination, too, certainly you could see a lot of interest once the first Northwest Mounted Police Post is set up in 1903 on the Mackenzie. And the high Arctic, you do start to see this association with sort of the policing of the North through the RCMP's dog team patrols. And that idea you were saying earlier about masculinity, certainly expressed in those stories of those exploits, those lonely Mounties in their lonely posts, bringing law and order, or basically Canadian criminal justice into the Arctic.
So Americans have a Wild West and Canada has a Wild North?
That's not an unfair comparison, actually. We wouldn't have called it wild, though. Our
what wild is it? Like a very Canadian concept.
Those Mounties were there to keep the peace. I remember we're all about peace, order, and good government. That's a thing up here.
Well, so why don't we talk about what's going on now in the Arctic with climate change? So first of all, I'm following along on a map on my phone of the Arctic, which I highly recommend our listeners to do because it's very illuminating and it helps to really put your mind. You talk about the spatial concept of looking at the world from the Arctic. It's helpful. But if we need to see evidence of climate change, you don't have to look any further than the Arctic, where I just saw an article from yesterday where an island has disappeared and a few other islands have been discovered. So maybe tell us first about what's happening now and how it's going to affect the rest of us in Canada and down here in North Carolina and Tennessee.
Well, that was the hardest part for me teaching the course, especially most recently to the larger class, was, you know, fascinating and interesting history. And then we get into the 21st century and we're looking at this room full of young people. And, you know, the story of climate change in the Arctic is, and its impact, its human impact, but also the kind of, and this is just from reading, I'm not a climate science expert. We've just read a fair bit of climate science. But the impact that the melting of the polar ice caps is going to have on the acceleration of global warming and the raising of the average temperature is really, really dramatic. And I don't think people really realize that. I know I didn't. The amount of sunlight that the polar ice cap currently reflects back, which means it's not available to dump heat into an energy into our atmosphere. As the snow begins to melt, as the ice cap recedes, it's not just that the water levels are rising, it's that now that white has been replaced by dark, and dark absorbs light, and light is energy. And that means we now have even an accelerated rate at which more energy is being dumped into the atmosphere, and more energy, heat energy, being dumped into our oceans. And so what's that going to mean for people in North Carolina? More storms and bigger storms. And so it's not just the waters are going to rise. Like, I think there's this passive idea that the global ice cap, you know, the polar ice caps melt and the huge Greenlandic ice shield, the ice cap, it melts. And so, okay, so the water levels rise. You know, I'll just move to higher ground. But the winds are what I think that was what really, really struck home is just and what's going to happen to the jet stream and the ways in which the polar region is so integral to global climate and to keeping the system stable. And so we're giving the students, these young people, reading on this and then realizing this is really grim. So, Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's going to have obviously a, if you look at any global warming maps, though, the temperature differentials are going to have the biggest impact in the polar regions at either end. So, you know, in here, we're going to see a moderate rise in Toronto. You know, and our summers are going to get a few degrees hotter. 10 years from now, we're going to be a few degrees hotter, our average temperature. But it's going to be like 10 to 15 degrees hotter up in Baffin Island and Ellesmere Island. And that's staggering.
So this article was filed 7 hours ago in the Barents Observer. The Arctic island that disappeared, the island of Perlamutrovi. Anybody? Perlamutrovi?
Sure.
It was discovered in the early 20th century and has since been part of all maps of the Arctic, but now the island of Perlamutrovi has simply vanished. And then the other article that was filed 2 hours ago in the Business Insider is titled, Russia and China Have Their Eyes on the Arctic, But It's Nobody's Lake, the top U.S. admiral in Europe says.
Yeah, and this is something I wanted to touch on here. So there's this region that is vital for all of us. And it seems to me like one of the interesting situations here is that it is crucial to all people, but there is no complete jurisdiction over it. So we could look at it as all of ours, or we could look at it as belonging to no one. Has there been in history any attempt to figure out a way to put together committees or councils or anything like this from different countries to allocate some responsibility for this place?
I mean, there is an Arctic Council, which is a sort of, you know, it's sort of like the Organization of American States, or it's like it's one of these big international councils that is, you know, the states of the Arctic. And the idea there. But of course, the question is what authority, you know, sort of comes out of groups like this. It's sort of everybody's in them because they believe in a sense that this is how it's going to how we can do things together. There are also some under the Arctic Council, but then also some in some other cases, associations of the various associations of the indigenous peoples of the Arctic, you know, and so it's not just the sort of titular states, you know, the U.S., Canada, Russia, Sweden, Finland, Norway,
Denmark.
I think that's it.
That's it.
But then also separate groups representing different Inuit groups, the Yakut, the Sami, the Komi. Like, so all of sort of when you go around like the ring of the Arctic, you can actually see fascinating sort of maps of the peoples that are all brought together in this. And, you know, one of the issues is that they have interests that are overlapping, but not entirely. Because, of course, one of the big, like when you actually go through and look at the various working groups of the Arctic Council, a huge number of them are actually about the environment, although it's not so much what it is about. It's about concern over, say, oil spills and oil drilling and others, not like the pollution of the Arctic, not the destruction of it due to global climate change. You know, so there's these facets, like there, like when you start with climate change, that's one thing, but then there's a whole other series of things that come in when you think about the health of the Arctic that have been both made possible by technology and the way, you know, sort of say the Arctic oil drilling and things like that, but then also creates all of these other potential, you know, real disasters.
So the United States is a member of the Arctic Council, but China is not.
Correct. Because they don't have Arctic. They are not in the Arctic.
But China seems to be making a strong play to make inroads into what I guess they call the Polar Silk Road.
Well, I mean, I you know, anybody, I suppose, with a port on the Atlantic or the Pacific, which is an awful lot of people, you know, could see that as a potential way, you know, to get things from one side of from the Atlantic to the Pacific. You know, the northern sea routes are opening up, and that is a thing, like, that's been going on. There's been a cruise ship now that's gone through, so you can take a cruise into the Arctic now. I don't know if
more
that's,
than one. No, it's,
yeah,
and you know, the passage is open. I mean, now for the summer months anyway, and so.
And so that is a real potential. It is not surprising to me that that is a thing that, you know, kind of an awful lot of people want to figure out ways to exploit.
So according to this article in the Business Insider that, again, was posted just a few hours ago, according to the United States military, we don't have vessel. Our vessels are too large to navigate through the Arctic. But however, the Chinese have a host of different varieties of vessels that can transit across the Arctic, so they want to be sure that they have a stake up there. That's a quote from our military.
Can I just be fair on this? So they're like, we built ships to go through the Arctic, so we get to go there. It reminds me of whenever I was a kid and I wanted a CD player for Christmas. So I just asked for CDs for my birthday 2 months earlier in hopes that later on I would get a CD player. It's like, you can't just do that. You know, I was 12 and even my mom was like, you can't just buy these and expect we'll get you a CD player.
This is going to be, I mean, this is the get down to the questions about international law and enforcement. Again, maritime law. This is, again, I'll say I'm a historian, not in my wheelhouse. But when you look at, you know, the current route of the, if you can, your viewers can sort of look at the current route ships take through the Arctic, through that passage, and you'll see it is fairly narrow in places. There are a couple of really shallow and thin area or narrow areas that the ships have to go through. But they are, you know, if the land around them belongs to Canada, then the waters should as well, which mean those were our Canadian coastal waters as opposed to international waters. But the reality has been, you know, foreign vessels have been going through there for quite some time. I mean, the Canadian government has invested in and does have a real state-of-the-art icebreaker, the Louis Saint-Laurent, but, you know, we don't have a big military. So this is going to be our big Navy. This is going to be a really interesting question. I know that people in the Canadian government who worry about these things. As that passage becomes more open, and as other routes open up, as the summer ice recedes, so the deeper waters are more navigable, then you're going to see, you're definitely going to see a lot of people looking at, and you realize how much time that route cuts off of global shipping. When you look at the world as from the top down and you realize what kind of an economic impact that would have on transportation costs and you understand the drive to send ships through there. People saw that opportunity in the 16th century, and they were trying then. So, you know, I certainly see it's going to happen. And so then the question is going to be, what are the different polar states? How are they going to respond to that? How are they going to regulate that space? And what's the impact going to be on the people who live in that space?
Yeah.
And that's going to be the really big question.
And will they be, you know, given the say that they probably ought to have?
Right, because they have historically been on what we consider the periphery, but for this, they are going to be in the center.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Bob, you have any follow-ups?
Well, I mean, I could ask the question and then fade off to go get my kids at school. Would you like me to better, or would you like to? Would you like
you
to
ask
do
the question. Okay. Bob, I want you to ask the question.
Okay. Well, the question we always ask here on The Road to Now, we believe that the individual narrative is impacted by and impacts the larger historical narrative. So for both of you, Allison and Heidi, how did you guys decide to become historians? What in your life drove you to want to become a historian? And again, we talked about this a little bit at the outset. What sparked your interest in the Arctic? And first, let me just say goodbye to both of you as I get off the line to go pick up my kids at school. Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation. I can't wait to listen to it. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's been fun. So I will start. I have a short version and a long version of this. I will try to go somewhere in the middle. But basically, in some ways, I think that I became a Russian historian because of the Cold War, in a lot of ways. And that's true for a couple of reasons. One is that my high school, I grew up just outside Chicago in Oak Park, Illinois, and my high school actually had a Russian history class that was started because after Sputnik went up, they thought maybe we should know more about these Russians, and they made the then youngest person in the history department teach a Russian class. And I took it the last year that he was teaching the class. And I took it because I had a spare space in my schedule. I'd had him for another class. I kind of liked him as a teacher. And I found it fascinating. I mean, all I can say is I found it more interesting than any other history class that I'd ever had before. And so I sort of thought as I went into undergraduate that, well, I'm probably going to be like practical and go to law school, but I'll take some Russian language because that would be cool. And then I decided that I didn't really, you know, I was going to be like an economics major. I decided I didn't like economics. I didn't think the world worked the way that the economics people thought it did.
No.
I know, shocking. And then also things like the Berlin Wall collapsed within, you know, like a month of my starting as an undergrad. And then the Soviet Union collapsed. And then I got to go to the brand new Russian Federation in 1992 on a language program. And so I just got really pulled into studying Russia.
And of the ways to study Russia, history was what drew me. So for me, it was very much a pull toward studying Russia with history as my way in. And then the different kinds of research I've done haven't particularly touched on the Arctic. You know, I do 18th and 19th century Russia. I've done work on food and the history of food and the history of social status. But this interest in the Arctic really was sparked by this one conversation that Heidi and I had. And it just made me sort of start, you know, when we're talking about mapping, talking about the different populations of the Arctic, it just really did spark this realization that that was such an interesting alternative way to view not just this version of a kind of oceanic history, looking at the Arctic Ocean, but also of Russian history, having this orientation to the north or from the north, as opposed to the always like Russia versus the West orientation, which is not absent in this too. Yeah. But this really does bring all of these different kinds of narratives to the forefront. I've just found it a really enlightening set of things to be sort of tracing through for teaching. I don't know that I'm ever going to actually write anything about this, but I found the process of teaching it to be utterly fascinating.
Yeah, and I want to jump in here and say this has actually been a great conversation, because sometimes it's like when you talk to somebody who's like I wrote this book, like here's what's in the book. I think there's something beautiful about sitting down and talking about things that you're still thinking about, that things that are still spinning your mind, the things that started from a good conversation with a colleague and then grew into something. I think there's something fun about being part of that process, and really like. I don't know. I think it's more exciting at this moment to talk about these things in a way that you're always still building. You haven't like built, and now let's talk about it. You know?
Absolutely. And can I also, yeah. I think that we often tend to think like that the only ways to have like intellectual community or to think about our, you know, sort of our interests as historians is by talking about our research. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think talking about our teaching and the things that we teach can also be ways of having just really sort of mind expanding conversations, can create these sort of senses of community amongst ourselves. And I think also there's some of the best ways to reach beyond sort of our relatively narrow group of specialists who work on things that are really closely related. Because when you actually start, say, co-teaching has been amazing for the ways that you learn things about stuff that you don't know that much about, not only when you stretch yourself by doing a topic that you're not that familiar with, but when you've got somebody else doing half the work, it's even better.
Well, and, you know, we attended each other's classes, and I have to say, like, I didn't really know much about Russian history. I mean, the broadest of brushstrokes before.
But now you know who Ivan the Terrible
is. I sure do. And it was just to sit in class and have that almost as an undergrad experience again, to sort of sit there and, well, that's really exciting. And when you do the comparative work and you see what the similarities are, but where you really see the big differences, that's when you start to recognize what's unusual in your own field of work as well. That really, it's like, you know, you think, oh, you know, this is the way colonialism is operated in all these different regions. Oh, that's some pretty common processes. Oh, wow, there's this, what's going on here in Canada? That's really different.
Or
here in Russia. And then you start, well, then why? So it feeds back into your own research too, because it takes you out of your zone and lets you see things about your own work that you hadn't even thought to, questions you hadn't even thought to ask.
Absolutely.
And that's been really great.
Also, how did you become a historian?
Oh, how did I become a historian? So this is a funny one. So I, like Allison, was going to do something practical. I was going to
You mean something else practical?
I was going to do something. I did something else practical. I was going to go to law school originally, and I loved history in high school, but I hated Canadian history in high school. Like, hated it.
And you grew up in Canada, right?
I grew up in Canada, and it was just so boring. And you couldn't, I don't know, we didn't seem to talk about conflict in Canada. I don't know why, but it was a different time.
Because it's nice here.
It's nice here. I don't know what it was about our curriculum in that period in the 70s. But I went to university to take a history major and then to go to law school. And my undergrad university, required that you take a full year of Canadian history in order to qualify for the major. So I switched majors to anthropology to avoid Canadian history. So the fact that I am now a professor of Canadian history is an irony that is not lost on me, and that I teach the undergraduate survey that I actually like changed majors to avoid is also pretty funny. But I actually ended up becoming a high school teacher. And I didn't go to law school. I ended up becoming a high school teacher. And then half the courses I had to teach was Canadian history, which I discovered was also really boring. So I went back to do a master's with the idea that I was going to go back into the classroom to write better Canadian history, or I was going to change careers. I liked the students. I hated the material. And when I got here, I found that a lot of the questions I had, which really, you know, were burbling up at a time when Canada was really for the first time starting to address issues with Indigenous peoples and the Crown and treaty relationships. There was a major confrontation in outside of Quebec and called the Oka Crisis. It happened while I was in my undergrad in 1990. And the military was actually called in to deal with a protest about development plans on a golf course that had been a burial ground. And, you know, this is a different kind of protest because there were like grandmothers there. And so, you know, there what was going on? And I realized these questions of why was I living in this place that was called Toronto, which is an Indigenous name, to Toronto, Ontario, Canada, is it, you know, these, all this indigeneity was around us and it was completely not talked about. Wasn't, you know, it was as if Indigenous people showed up at the very beginning of your courses, you know, and then they disappeared. And I just wondered why and what happened. And it's been an amazing journey.
Yeah, it is. It is much more amazing. Like, I think history is more dynamic when you keep all the people involved as much as possible. And when you're teaching the big picture classes, it's hard. But I think it's more interesting. Like when I was doing my readings and everything for my dissertation and for my graduate work, I actually thought to myself, one of the criticisms I've always had of American history is that you leave the Native American people out. And that's why Doug Northrup at Michigan was nice enough. I was a grad student at Michigan State. He was nice enough to be part of my reading field because I was like, I don't want to replicate the same problems in the teaching that I do. And I did a subfield on Central Asia. And for those of you folks out there who are thinking about history, like, I think it's important to remember all of these players, remember that they matter as much as anybody else. And I think it's amazing to see that, like, you know, again, with all our guests, you're shaped by the world you live in. And the questions you ask is shaped by the world you live in. And I don't know. It's amazing. And that's why I said also practical field, because there's so much practical you can do when you know these things.
Oh, yeah. And I think that both of our statements about practical is because that's what I think most brand new undergraduates come in thinking, like that history is not practical. Well, yeah, we know that this is a thing that people think, that history is not practical. And I think that, like, there have been plenty of studies out there that show that, you know, some, like X number of years out, and it's not that many from an undergrad degree that say, like, earning potentials when you look at this, like, history actually does just fine.
Yeah.
It's just that there's not an obvious immediate practical thing when you finish, as opposed to, like, a business degree or a commerce degree, you know, or something like that. But that doesn't mean that it's not actually kind of practical in both knowing, like, real stuff and then also knowing how to read and how to, like, all of the basic you learn how to read to write. But you also just get to spend some time thinking about really important questions that sometimes seem like they're really distant, but that are actually well, your thing is called The Road to Now, that are, like, about how we get to now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, you know, in Canada, you can't ignore the fact that in 2015, we had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that addressed the Canadian government's policy of cultural genocide towards Indigenous peoples. I mean, it's a similar process in the United States, but Canada embraced it with a different intensity. But there's also been a really good conversation and a national commission that reported on that. And there have been lots of institutional now beginnings of reflections. I mean, not to say that there are still really significant problems in this country, both the treaty relationships, which are foundational to the country, but also with systemic racism. But it's good to see that the conversation's starting. And it's also really fascinating to see the role of history, how history's been implicated in that process, because, you know, the stereotypes people have and then information people have about Indigenous peoples in Canada, their politics, their relationships with the Crown have been shaped by some really quite not good, in fact, bad scholarship that has then, you know, made its way into school curricula that's actually, you know, replicated, you know, these really problematic discourses. And so, you know, we do have a really important role to play as historians, as well as correcting that record.
I think there's often this assumption that people have when they're being sort of dismissive of history or the humanities in general, has been like, oh, well, there are no right answers in that. And I think that the problem with that is that it's true that sometimes there's more than one way to interpret things. So sometimes there might be more than one right answer, but that doesn't mean there aren't wrong answers. Mm-hmm. Like there are things that just like didn't happen or that are not acceptable extrapolations from whatever evidence that we have. And so, you know, I think that sort of thinking about the ways that we talk about what it is that we're doing and why what we do is important and actually practical sort of needs to remember that too. Mm-hmm.
One of the big criticisms I hear people say is these folks are always trying to rewrite history. And I'm like, well, let's think about this. Somebody wrote it the first time. And if you think that they killed it in the 1880s and that we don't need to redo it, tell me something else you think we had perfectly right in the 1880s that you don't want to update.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. You know? I like that. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, Allison Smith, thanks for being on The Road to Now.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Heidi Boker, thank you for being on The Road to Now.
Thank you.
And I hope you all have a great day in Toronto. And thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia. As always, also, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout-out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, and the newest one, Susan Sharp. If you'd like to support us and what we do, you can do that on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. We're working on some pretty cool stuff over there, so I'm excited to share that with y'all. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. Osiris.